Now, Michael Toms interviews Neil Donald Walsh.
I'd like to talk about some of the things that are in the book and how the book is presented. One of the aspects I notice is that the book seems to have a largely Christian orientation, though there was cursory mention of other spiritual traditions. What about that largely Christian orientation, Neil?
Well, I don't experience it as having a largely Christian orientation. In fact, I think, as a matter of fact, I think that the people who would argue the most that it has anything but a Christian orientation would be devout Christians, and certainly born-again Christians and fundamentalists would be the first to disagree with you. They would almost scoff at anyone's description of this book as having a largely Christian orientation. In fact, some have said that the book was written by just the opposite, by the Antichrist. So I find your observation to be somewhat unique among the reactions that I received to the book. Although it is true that the great teacher Jesus has been mentioned a number of times in the book, I suspect that that had to do with the fact that God speaks to each of us along the avenues and through the channels with which she knows we are deeply familiar. And because my own particular upbringing and background happened to be in the largest of the Christian sects, the Roman Catholic Church, I believe that it was not inappropriate nor terribly unexpected that God would use the teacher with whom I was most familiar to make some very important points. In that context, I understand your question. God has said to us in the book that he will use any device, any tool, any channel, the lyrics of the next song you hear, the storyline of the next movie you watch, or the words of any teacher with which you are deeply familiar and to which you are emotionally attached. And I think, therefore, that we can expect God to show up in our lives and to communicate with us in our lives through the mediums with which we are most personally familiar. Therefore, it is not at all shocking to me that the revelations, and I use that word advisedly, received by peoples elsewhere in the world, differ in tone, but rarely in content, from the revelations in conversations with God, and that difference of tone or nuance has to do with the adjustments that God has made, if you will, to the awarenesses and the consciousness of the messenger. And so God will speak to someone in the Middle East, I'm certain, with constructions and nuances that are largely Middle Eastern in their theological approach.
Speaking of God using anything and everything to communicate with us, in the book it says that feelings are a channel for the truth. Feelings are the language of the soul. Feelings can run the gamut from anger to love and have been the cause of many wars and conflicts over the centuries, even to this day and time. How do you reconcile this apparent dichotomy of feelings and truth?
The statement actually is feelings are the language of the soul. Now we'll get back into my own theological constructions here. I do use the figure of Jesus as a point of reference because he is the master teacher, one of many, with whom I am most familiar. And so in response to your question, I'll begin by saying even Jesus experienced anger. And the story of his driving the money changers out of the temple was not placed in the Bible without awareness on the part of those who were constructing that that scriptural collection. They were deeply aware that in order for us to truly understand spiritual truth, in order for us to deeply understand spiritual truth, we needed to be given a model and an example of a person who allowed himself to genuinely experience all the feelings that he was feeling. The question, therefore, before human race is not whether we ought to allow ourselves or to look inside of ourselves for the truth of our feelings, but how we ought to express those feelings in a way that allows us to elevate our experience of who and what we are. Anger in itself is not a negative emotion. Anger is simply a gift from God, a way that we have of saying no thank you, a way that we have of causing others to notice that something is something or another is not okay with us. It is rarely an emotion, or I should say rarely a feeling, that is inappropriate. Feelings are, by definition, never inappropriate because, in fact, it's how we feel. And we get into more trouble by trying to deny that we feel a certain way in order to come off within our own constructions as holy or as healed, or as altogether. And this sublimation of our feelings, this repression, is what creates a great deal of the psychological difficulties confronting humankind. Therefore, I think it's the free expression and the free flow of our deepest feelings which produces the greatest freedom. Now, the question, therefore, is not ought we to express our feelings freely, or not even, the question isn't even, is it good or is it okay to have a negative feeling, like anger or even hatred or envy or jealousy or rage? Those issues are not the real issues. The issue is when we feel rage, when we feel anger, when we feel any negative emotion, what do we do in response to that? What is the way we deal with that? And what action do we allow ourselves and permit ourselves to take as a result of that? And it is in the answer to that question that mastery is found, not in the sublimation of the feeling itself. If you want to know what's true for you, just listen to your feelings.
When I hear you say listen to your feelings, I hear you talking about listening deeply, not in a shallow way.
Well, actually, I'm talking about both, Michael. I think first we have to listen in a shallow way to what's coming up for us in the instant moment. And then after we hear what's really true for us in the instant moment about a thing, then if we have the willingness and the desire and the level of mastery, I want to say, that allows us to go deeper, then we look even more deeply into that first flush of feeling to see what feeling is behind the feeling, if you will, and more deeply and more deeply and more deeply, like layers of, you know, of onion skin from the onion, until we peel away all but the deepest feeling and the purest thought. So, but I don't think it starts there. I mean, I think you have to begin to look at the most shallow feelings and look at them, frankly, in a rather superficial way, as in simply, hey, I'm angry here, or that really upsets me, or I'm jealous. I'm just simply jealous. I don't want you going out until 10 o'clock with that other guy, or whatever it is that's coming up for you, just to be able to notice it, to hold it, to speak it, to be safe with it, to feel okay with it, to stop condemning ourselves about even our most shallow interpretation of our feelings. Because it is after we get through the shallow water that we can submerge ourselves in the deep. One doesn't dive to the bottom without going through the top.
Another aspect in the book is that love and fear seem to be in opposition. Can you explain that further?
In truth, love and fear are not in opposition, and the book makes very clear that there is only one thing, and that's love, and that love is all there is. And the book makes that statement repeatedly so that we might understand what is really so. Nevertheless, within the context of love being all there is, we see that there can be polarities. Let me relate this to the color white. White is not the absence of every other color, but rather it is the inclusion of all colors. And every other color in the universe put together and mixed in together produces white. That's also true with love. Love is not the absence of anger. It's not the absence of negative emotion, but in fact the inclusion of every single kind of emotion that there is. All of it put together is the thing we call love, which word we use interchangeably, some of us, with the word God, and that God is love and love is God, and those two words are interchangeable. Now, having announced and proclaimed that in highest truth, love is all there is, or if you will, God is all there is, God then described to us the relative universe, and in the book, Conversations with God, this is described in some considerable, and I want to say elegant, detail. Describing the relative universe where we established two polarities, if you will, and a system of duality that includes left and right, now and then, before and after, male and female, up and down, fast and slow, good and evil, and love and fear. And that the two ends of these of this duality, love on one side and fear on the other, are really, if you can see it in your mind's eye, the two sides of a circle. That is to say, love is at, let's say, nominally 9 o'clock, and fear is at 3 o'clock. Most people start off at noon and get down to 3 and have to go through fear to get to love. It's quite interesting. But if you hold the picture of a circle in your mind's eye, or the face of a clock, you will see that love is on one side, in my construction, and fear is at the other, but they're all the same thing. See, they're all the same circle. And yet, without love being on one side and fear being on the other, or what we call love and call fear in the relative experience known as the human adventure of life, without our definition of those two sides of the circle itself cannot exist. And the book explains rather in great detail how this system of relativity works, and how, in the world of duality, a thing cannot exist without its direct opposite. Therefore, up is just a concept and not a reality without down. Fast is merely a concept having no reality in time and space without slow. And similarly, all parts of the duality, including love and fear. And therefore, in order for love to exist as an experienceable, there's a coin a word, as an experienceable energy in the universe, love, there must be that thing in our system of duality that we call fear. In the absence of what you are not, that which you are cannot be. I'll say that again. In the absence of that which you are not, that which you are cannot be. That is to say, in the absence of up, you cannot be down. In the absence of cold, you cannot be hot. In the absence of evil, you cannot be the thing called good. Not in this relative universe. In the realm of the absolute, where God resides, of course, one can be all those things, and one is all those things simultaneously. But in order for us to experience, in order for us to know experientially these concepts, which is, of course, the purpose of the human soul, we needed to create, and God needed to create, I use the word we and God interchangeably here, a system of duality and a system of polarities. Therefore, love and fear exist as two sides of the same circle, and yet it's all the same stuff. Some people choose to picture love and fear as two ends of a long rod or a long straight line, with love on one side and fear on the other, and in this way, in their mind, they construct a mental image, if you will, of the great polarity. That isn't the image of the great polarity at all. The image is the one I gave you, a circle, with love at 9 o'clock and fear at 3. And as soon as you bend that rod around and connect it to itself, you see the beautiful symmetry and the awesome simplicity of the design.
Conversations with God takes the form of book 1, 2, and 3. Is this all God has to say, or will there be more volumes?
I really don't know, Michael. This is a risky thing to say. Part of me hopes that it ends with book 3. Because people are beginning to look at me as some kind of source for enormous truth and for deep insight and instant understanding of the most profound concepts with which the human race has confronted itself. And that is not a place with which I am most comfortable. And so it's become a very interesting experience for me in my life. And if the dialogue were over with the end of book 3, it would not displease me, and I would have an opportunity to remove myself from that position as the current messenger of the moment. God help me if Conversations with God or Neil Donald Walsh turns into the latest fad. That would defeat the purpose of everything I've tried to do. On the other hand, if when book 3 is finished, and by the way, the concepts I just described to you of the circle and so forth, all of those visual constructions are part of book 3. Book 3 deals with the larger cosmology of all of it. And if at the end of book 3, it's clear to me that another book or more material or the dialogue is continuing and more material is coming, then I'm not obviously going to turn away from that. I've announced and declared myself to be a willing messenger of the grandest truth that I am capable of accessing, announcing to the world as I do so that I freely admit the filtering system which is in place in my own mind through which I seek to bring these revelations. And I'm aware that there's a filtering system there. So I don't claim, nor do I represent myself as infallible, nor do I claim infallibility. But I think that the material speaks for itself in terms of its clarity, in terms of the depth of its insights, and in terms of the eternality of its wisdom. This book contains eternal wisdom, and so do all 3 books. Will there be a book 4 or a book 5? Well, No, there will not, unless there are.
There are two other books that come through in a similar way as the Conversations with God. One is the Urantia book, and another is A Course in Miracles.
Yes, I've been told by many people that Conversations with God is A Course in Miracles made accessible. That is to say, you can read it more than one paragraph at a time without getting lost in the circular construction. I thought that A Course in Miracles was an extraordinary document, but very difficult to plow through for large numbers of people because of the circular constructions and because of the way it was simply put together. To some degree, the same is true of the Urantia material, with which I have become familiar. But Conversations with God, I believe, and again, I don't say this from any standpoint of ego, because I was simply not involved in it except as a scribe. But as the scribe of that material, I can say that Conversations with God, I believe, is the first book to use such extraordinarily accessible language, such easy-to-understand constructions, and such totally visible wisdoms that even the most uninitiated among us can pick up that book and say, I got it. I got it. It's clear. Now I understand. And we're getting 200 and 300 letters a week at this point from people all over the world saying exactly that. The most delicious comment of all that I received in the past year about this extraordinary material, thank you, one lady said to me, for introducing me to a God I can fall in love with.